Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Breaking news. President Donald Trump tweeted earlier today that he has accepted EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt's resignation. Trump said that the agency's Deputy Administrator Andrew Wheeler will become the acting head of EPA. Now, my count shows Pruitt is the 30th administration departure since Trump took office 17 months ago. The departure follows months of scrutiny that gathered momentum following reports that Pruitt had rented a Capitol Hill condominium linked to an energy lobbyist on favorable terms. The revelation exacerbated concerns about the high cost of Pruitt's travel and security detail and triggered a flood of allegations that Pruitt fostered a culture of workplace retaliation, wasteful spending, and self-dealing at EPA. It is alleged he asked an aide to find his wife a $200,000 a year job and kept a secret calendar to hide meetings which might not look good, and asked an agency official to carry out a number of personal tasks for him, including an effort to buy used mattresses from the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. From the start, Pruitt's agenda was not one of protecting the environment by curbing pollutants and mitigating the impacts of climate change. He offered certainty to the energy companies, automakers, and other business interests he was supposed to be regulating. Trump ran on a slogan of draining the swamp. Well, another one of the swamp creatures Trump brought with him has, in fact, slithered away into the sunset. Trump administration was just ordered to end indefinite detention of asylum seekers. A fourth district federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ruled that the government may not arbitrarily detain people seeking asylum who have shown credible evidence that they were fleeing persecution in their home countries and are awaiting immigration hearings. This is a practice that breaks the government's own policies as well as international law. In the past, refugees seeking asylum in the U.S. have been required to prove to officials that they have a credible fear of returning to their home country due to political unrest, violence, or persecution. A 2009 directive allows for those who can prove credible fear to be released from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, custody while they await an immigration hearing unless they are considered a flight risk or a danger to the public. In a court challenge, lawyers for nine plaintiffs who had been held in detention presented evidence that parole rates under the Trump administration have plummeted more than 90% to nearly zero, a shift they attributed to the government's new zero-tolerance policy on immigration and an attempt to deter would-be asylum seekers from traveling to the United States and making a claim. Judge Boasberg said the government denied that it had any blanket policy of denying release to asylum applicants, but failed to rebut the plaintiff's figures demonstrating the steep drop in releases since Mr. Trump took office. Judge Boasberg has determined that the government can't summarily detain people out of hand, and the Trump administration cannot use indefinite detention as a weapon to punish and deter asylum seekers. Senator Lindsey Graham warns U.S. withdrawal from Syria would be terrible during surprise visit to Manbij. According to a story written by Whitney Webb for Mint Press, after meeting with Turkish leadership over the weekend, Senators Lindsey Graham from South Carolina and Gene Shaheen from New Hampshire made a surprise visit on Monday to Manbij, where they met with members of the Manbij Military Council, a Kurdish militia that operates as part of the umbrella group, the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF. A recent Turkish-American deal has eased tension between the two NATO allies over Manbij, which is administered by U.S.-backed Kurdish-led forces Ankara considers terrorists. Under the deal, which has unnerved Washington's Syria allies, the Kurdish militia, now in the town, would withdraw from Manbij, President Donald Trump has said he wants U.S. troops to return home. After visiting a city market and speaking with militia members, Graham told MMC officials that, "I will tell President Trump that it's important we stay here to help you. You are friends of the United States, and if we leave, it will be terrible." Graham has long been known for his hawkish stance on Syria, having criticized the U.S. strikes on three alleged Syrian chemical weapon sites this past April for not going far enough, calling the strikes a missed opportunity. Graham said it would be terrible if Americans leave. According to Webb, Graham's statements during his visit to Manbij are unusual given that the senator has not always backed U.S. support of Syrian Kurds. Indeed, last year, Graham strongly criticized the U.S. alliance with Kurdish groups connected to the People's Protection Units, or YPG, and a Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, both of which are considered terrorist groups by the Turkish government but also form the backbone of the U.S.-allied SDF. Given that Graham described his recent weekend meeting with Turkish President Erdogan as very good, respectful, and candid, and asserted that the U.S. needs Turkey as a strategic partner, it remains to be seen how Graham plans to walk the fine line between his recently voiced support of Kurdish fighters and his desire to maintain a strong relationship with Turkey. Man exonerated after 30 years in prison. 30 years ago, Jerome Johnson was convicted of the murder of Aaron Taylor inside the Night Owl Bar in Baltimore, Maryland. For 30 years, Jerome Johnson maintained that he was innocent. On Monday, a judge agreed. Johnson had been convicted on inconsistent and faulty witness testimony. When the 50-year-old stepped from the Baltimore Circuit Courthouse in downtown Baltimore a free man, he hugged his brother and softly thanked his attorneys before a crowd of onlookers. Johnson went to prison at the age of 20 and spent the last 30 years of his life behind bars, the victim of inconsistent and faulty witness testimony. A supposed witness initially told investigators Aaron Taylor's shooter pulled a gun from his waistband. Later, the witness changed her story. She told police that Johnson handed the shooter the gun. Jerome Johnson's defense attorneys were not told of the witness's first statement, which made her story inconsistent. The Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal defense organization at the George Washington University, took up Johnson's case and helped set him free. The Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project is a nonprofit founded in 2000. It works to correct and prevent the conviction of innocent people in Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia. Officials say they have helped secure the release and exoneration of 28 innocent men who served a combined 494 years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Mr. Jerome Johnson has spent his entire adult life in prison. He has now to reconcile and find peace with that fact that we live in a country that can take 29, almost 30 prime years away from an innocent man for a crime he did not commit. Think back to 2003 when Illinois Governor George Ryan called the death penalty process in Illinois arbitrary and capricious and therefore immoral, and cleared Illinois' death row. He commuted 167 condemned inmates' sentences in the broadest attack on the death penalty in decades. When he did that, conservatives called him everything but a child of God. Even though Jerome Johnson was not on death row, this is just another example of the injustices done by the American so-called justice system. Between the extrajudicial murders such as Antoine Rose II and disproportionate number of African Americans incarcerated, that takes me back to the Richard Pryor line, "It is the justice system because when you look into the system, all you see is just us." You are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Yesterday, most Americans celebrated Independence Day, commemorating the adoption of the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. The first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence are powerful and important. They read, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Yesterday's tradition of celebration was meaningful to all and has become troubling to many. For further insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He has served on the front lines of American civil rights formation and public policy since 1989, having been trained at the historic law firm of Hill, Tucker, and Marsh in Richmond, Virginia. He served as vice president and national field director for Reverend Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Push Coalition from 1997 to 2007 in Chicago, Illinois. He was executive director and CEO of the Black Leadership Forum. He's been a public policy analyst at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and he currently hosts The Gary Flowers Show on radio station Rejoice WREJ 101.3 FM and AM 990.9 from 9 to 11 a.m. on weekdays. Gary Flowers, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, I'm glad to be invited again, and you are definitely my brother from another mother, and I thank you for the work that you do across the airwaves and spreading good information to the people.
Gary, thank you. I really appreciate that. Would you agree with my premise that yesterday's tradition of celebration was meaningful to all and has become troubling to too many?
Absolutely. Let's unpack the knapsack. Before we can evaluate July 4th, 2018, we, of course, must look at July 4th, 1852, with the words of Frederick Douglass. And then the marking of July 4th, 1776. But prior to that, prior to all this language about independence, the United States of America initially was formed as 13 separate colonies. Those colonies were outgrowths of an empire known as England. And they were companies to make money and profit for the empire. So in Virginia, my home state, there was the London Company of Virginia. In the Massachusetts, the London Company of Massachusetts. And so when we evaluate what the words mean in the Declaration of Independence, they ring hollow primarily because it was then and it is now a country based on profit and exploitation of labor. And so when 1852 comes along, there is no contradiction in the minds of many white landowners because they are profiting. And so therefore, they are American. And that, to me, is the question of the day. What is America? For whom? And by whom?
On the last day of the Constitutional Convention of 1787, Benjamin Franklin was asked, as he left Independence Hall, this is according to the notes of Dr. James McHenry, one of the Maryland delegates to the convention, a lady walked up to Dr. Franklin and she said, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Franklin replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." Should we look at the last 10 years of American policy with with real emphasis on the past 17 months with zero tolerance, the Muslim ban, etc., as just the ugly process of democracy, or the analogy being the sausage-making process? Or is it evidence that American Jeffersonian democracy or the constitutional republic is failing?
I think we look at it in two ways. One, the experiment itself is noble. There was no other country in the history of the planet that attempted to do what America sought in its ideals. But there were two major thorns. One, I mentioned earlier, which is the exploitation of labor. And secondly, has been the thread of race. And when you put those two together with a combustible agent known as the occupier of the current White House, then they can fall apart really fast. Why? If you ask Richard Spencer or Jason Kessler, who organized the marches and rallies in Charlottesville, Virginia last August that killed Heather Heyer, they will say that America was built for and established by whites. And so therefore, America is a white proposition. If you add that to the exploitation of labor, remember, Adolf Hitler was elected. And when we talk about the constitutional republic, there are many people in this society that could care less about a constitutional republic. Because of their perception of race, they want a white nation back as though they ever had one. And they are willing to put up with an autocrat, even someone who's dim-witted, if they can feel as though that this country will be white again. And as far-fetched as that may sound to those of us with a conscience, there are many people and a growing number of people who are believers. The media itself helped to create Donald J. Trump. They gave him a lot of free airtime when they didn't think that he would be elected president. And now that he is, they're still profiting from him every day. And that, to me, is as much part of the waning of democracy as it is the experiment itself.
You mentioned the ideals of the country, and that takes me back when I was in Iran in 2015. I was lecturing probably about seven or eight different universities throughout the country. And in three different instances, I want to say it was the same person who stood up and asked, "Are you proud to be an American?" Now, the structure of that sentence coming from that individual made me think that the individual was, that question was actually planted, but that's a whole nother discussion. My answer to the audience was, of course I'm proud to be an American. And when I said that, in each instance, the place went nuts. And then I'd say to them, but what you have to understand is, I'm proud to be an American based upon the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and what is stated in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights being part of that Constitution. I am not proud of what America is doing under the name of Americans, but I am very proud of what the country is struggling or supposed to be struggling to accomplish. And the second point that you mentioned about Donald Trump, there are a lot of people who voted for him who don't, I think to your point, don't care a lick about the policy. And in many instances, they don't even really care about the impact that the policies are going to have on them. They want somebody who's speaking their language and is fighting for what they have been convinced to be their interests. As Tom Porter would say, they rather eat their racism than sit down and have a fine meal.
And I mean, if we look at it, what are the tenets of fascism? Powerful and continuing nationalism, a disdain for human rights, an identification of enemies as a unifying cause for a political base, supremacy of the military, rampant sexism, controlled mass media, obsession with national security, Religion and government intertwined, corporate power protected, labor power suppressed, detained for intellectuals in the arts, obsession with crime and punishment, rampant cronyism and corruption. That is what we are seeing in the White House today. And there are plenty of people who call themselves Americans who put on, speaking of desecration of the flag, who put on all sorts of flag hats, shirts, bikinis, and short sets yesterday and claim to be true Americans, and yet they have no problem with an autocratic leader being born in front of us that is fascist in ideals and in practice.
And is willing to do everything in his power to push the envelope to take the country into another war.
Yes, they're itching for whether it's domestic or international. If you look at, I conduct a lot of opposition research, both on the airwaves as well as the internet. And if you look at the discussions from neo-Confederates, they are itching for a second American Civil War.
They're arming themselves and training themselves to engage in that activity. And they're not out there, as Donald Trump would call them, playing war games. They're out there, as we would say, on the for real.
Yes. Now, you would ask, what would be the basis for a second American Civil War? If the first one was enslavement, what would they want to fight for now? Re-enslavement. So the idea that white women and men are calling the police because people are being black somewhere is an indication that it's not about public policy. It's not about the Declaration of Independence. It is about their perception of the false notion of white supremacy and white originality, not knowing that none of what they believe is scientifically based.
Even the whole construct of race, there is no biological, no medical, no scientific empirical data to support even the whole premise of the language of race. You mentioned earlier in the conversation, you mentioned Frederick Douglass. 166 years ago today, the great abolitionist and advisor to President Lincoln spoke to the Ladies Anti-Slavery Society in Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. The title of his remarks was "What to the Slave is the 4th of July?" It was delivered July 5th, 1852. Douglass said, "The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight." Gary, today we could say the distance between today and the slave plantation from which many of our ancestors were released is considerable. But as we look at the data, mass incarceration, education disparities, health disparities, the renewed attack on voting and affirmative action, the Muslim ban, how far have we really come?
It's worse. Well, I actually say it's more dismal and daunting than we actually admit to. Why? Here's why. We have the first and going on the second generation since 1865 less educated than the previous. Let me say that again slowly. The first and almost the second generation of black Americans less educated than the previous. That is very, very daunting to our survival. One of the things that I learned from Reverend Jackson is to remain employed is to remain necessary. Well, in some ways in this country, to remain viable part of society is to have a skill and remain necessary. There's a generation of black Americans that are unnecessary to this country, having no skill, little to no education, perhaps unwed babies, and an idea that fun and sun is really the order of the day.
That takes me back to the great work of Samuel Yett, his book, The Choice, where he says, and I'll paraphrase, all the dishes have been washed, all the wood has been chopped, all the water has been hewn, all the shoes have been shined. We have now become an obsolete people.
Yes. And we, those of us who care, those of us who are conscious, have to dedicate our waking hours to rebuilding a sense of purpose, a sense of duty, and a sense of, really for no other reason in this country, a sense of patriotism. And what I mean, I don't mean that blindly to the red, white, and blue, but I mean that to the nation and to the Constitution if we actually believe that it's achievable. Frederick Douglass, when asked, was there a Negro problem in the late 1800s, said, there is no Negro problem. The problem is whether the American people have the loyalty, honor, and patriotism enough to live up to their own Constitution. Those of us who are African American have to do that on double time because we're so far behind in terms of these indices you just mentioned.
He also, in that incredible speech, said, this, for the purpose of this celebration, is the 4th of July. It is the birthday of your national independence and of your political freedom. This, to you, is what the Passover was to the emancipated people of God. It carries your minds back to the day and to the fact of your great deliverance and to the signs and to the wonders associated with that act and that day. He was making a very, very clear delineation between them and us at that time. And in spite of the legislation that has been passed, in spite of the progress in some regards that has been made, there is still this very clear delineation between the them and the us, as evidenced by your point, people calling the police on African-American political candidates who are going through a neighborhood canvassing door to door.
As though that's a crime. And once again, that is just an African-American woman walking while black. Because the person who called the police had no idea what she was doing on her cell phone. So with that in mind, we have a pregnant moment in American history because there are many who sat on the outside and said this experiment would never work. And with some of the vitriolic language and actions that are going on now, if not for the government, it's going to have to be people like you and me who are on the radio waves and television networks who can get messages to the masses that have to redirect the ship. At least have people who are the oppressed have a greater interest in their resurrection.
You know, you mentioned the Negro problem, and that takes me back to the point of all that's being asked is for America to live up to its promise and ideal. That's all anybody is asking, not more, not less. You wrote it down. You put it on paper. You signed your name to it.
You sold it to the world.
And you sold it to the world and will take it to the world at the barrel of a gun.
And take their resources in the name of it.
And overthrow those countries such as Vietnam that were trying to emulate the document that you hold in such high esteem. Just live up to the precepts that you claim you want to live by.
That's why I think the question of the day, there are two questions of the day. One is, what is America? Who is America? That's a two-part question. The other is, what role will you play in the resistance? If we have a burgeoning totalitarian government that appears to be fascist in its practices, then people of goodwill, people of good conscience, and people of intellect must now decide what role they will play in the resistance.
And when you talk about fascists, you also have to throw in neoliberal. You can't leave that one out. Gary Flowers, you brought it, my brother. Thank you so much. You are the host of the Gary Flowers Show on radio station Rejoice, WREJ, 101.3 FM and AM 990 in Richmond, Virginia, 9 to 11 a.m. weekdays. Gary Flowers, man, thanks for coming on the Critical Hour.
Thanks so much, and keep up the good work, Dr. Leon. We can win when we fight together. We must fight now with our minds and our intellect and our souls.
My brother, thank you so much. Thank you. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. As I mentioned in the first segment, the Trump administration was just ordered to end indefinite detention of asylum seekers. A Fourth District federal judge in Washington has ruled that the government may not arbitrarily detain people seeking asylum who have shown credible evidence that they were fleeing persecution in their home countries and are awaiting immigration hearings, a practice that breaks the government's own policies as well as international law. What's going on with detained migrants and asylum seekers? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's the founding director of Friends of Broward Detainees, a volunteer visitation program that provides humanitarian support for unauthorized immigrants and asylum seekers inside the Broward Transitional Center, the Immigrant Detention Center in South Florida. She is Christine Ho. Welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leon, for having me. I'm very honored to be invited to speak with you today.
Thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for giving us time out of what I know is an incredibly, incredibly busy schedule. First, what is the mission of Friends of Broward County Detainees? When was it established and why?
Well, it was established about 4 years ago, and I, at that time, I had just I had published my third book titled "Humane Migration," which is a human rights approach to migration policy. And in the course of doing the research for that book, I discovered how appalling detention is, and decided I needed to do something practical about it. So it took me a while to figure out exactly how to do this. But the mission of Friends of Broward Detainees is to provide humanitarian support for people inside. And the things that we offer are face-to-face visits. Some of the people we visit, on the first visit, we discover that they haven't seen or spoken to anyone from the outside for 6 months or longer. So it's to provide them with human contact and to let them know that someone knows they exist and also cares about them. So we provide face-to-face visits. We also try to help them stay in touch with their families on the outside. We try to find sponsors for them to make it easier for them to be released. And a very difficult thing we try to do is to find them pro bono attorneys, which is very difficult in the state of Florida. But we try. And so those are the kinds of things that my organization tries to provide. We also are mindful of the conditions in which these people live, and living conditions are generally poor. The food is generally bad, as well as the medical care. In fact, Human Rights Watch published a report a couple of weeks ago about how substandard medical care has been blamed for many of the deaths in detention.
Mm-hmm.
And So living conditions are bad. There are everyday humiliations and indignities and pettiness. An example that comes to mind is on one occasion I tried to visit a young man from Ethiopia. And while I was, I was waiting a long time in the visitation room, and I asked the guard, what's keeping him, And the guard said, well, he's not going to you won't be able to visit him today. I said, why not? He said, because his shoelaces were not tied properly. So he's not going to be allowed to have a visit today. So that's the kind of pettiness that, that I'm referring to. The other thing that happens frequently is that people get transferred across the country like so many chess pieces. I am not sure exactly what the justification is for doing that, but they are transferred on a regular basis. Now, apart from the trauma of being moved, it also, being transferred also takes them away from any family, friends, or friends in a local area who might be able to visit them and provide social support for them. But most importantly, when they get transferred, they're also removed from their lawyers if they're lucky enough to have one. And while it's possible to have an attorney work by remote control, it's not by no means ideal. Because an attorney needs to be there in the courtroom when you have your court hearing.
Right.
So so detention is no picnic, is the best way I can summarize it. For both, not only for children, which is the concern of the hour, but also for adults. And the people inside Broward Transitional Center are all adults. There are no children there. But it's stressful for them anyhow. There's a lot of psychological research that shows that detention is very stressful and causes both mental as well as other medical issues. And it's especially stressful for those who are detained for a long time, and those would be asylum seekers. Because although the United States recognizes the right to seek asylum, the process of processing asylum claims can take a very long time. For example, a series of court hearings and appeals can take months, even years. And the people on our visitation roster right now, most of them have been in detention for more than a year. Last weekend, I visited people who've been there for 18 months, which is a very long time.
You mentioned humane migration, the concept of humane migration. And I think most of us in this country, that if we spend any time thinking about this issue, we tend to look at it as kind of them versus us. And we have people coming from Mexico. We have people coming from El Salvador, from Guatemala, who are taking it upon themselves to leave horrific conditions in their country and come here. And so we look at it as that's on them until they get here. So can you elaborate a little bit on your concept of humane migration? Because that, to me, infers a much broader view of the process that we may not be willing to look at or able to comprehend without you elaborating on. Does that question make sense?
Yes, it does. And actually, if we take a broader view, we should also know that not all we tend to have a view that most of the people crossing the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, come from Central America, three specific countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. And it's true that the majority who cross the border come from those countries, but actually people come from all over the world. And, for example, most of the people that are being visited by Friends of Broward at the moment come from Africa. And they have come a long, long way from the other side of the planet on a very arduous journey that can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to get here. Many of them, most of them, are asylum seekers. And by that I mean these are people who are seeking protection from persecution, imprisonment, torture, and death threats in their homeland. And so they come here expecting to be, well, they come here believing the U.S. to be the land of freedom and democracy and expecting to be welcomed with open arms. And instead, they are, you know, thrown into, they're locked up. That's the best way to put it. And so it's, you know, it's very stressful for them because with the asylum seekers, as I mentioned, they're in there for much longer than so-called undocumented workers who tend to be deported rather quickly. But asylum seekers stay a long time. And psychological research shows that thoughts about suicide and self-harm are quite common in detention, especially for those who are there a very long time. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, one of the young men I used to visit from Eritrea killed himself.
I heard that story, yes.
Yeah, right, right. So I won't elaborate on that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, elaborating on what I mean by humane migration. As I mentioned, the conditions in detention are, in my view, not humane because most of these people are not criminals, are not charged with any crime. They are, because to cross the border and reside in the U.S., at least the first time, is not a felony and it's not a crime. It's a civil offense, a misdemeanor. But when they're in detention, they are treated like just like a criminal. They're shackled when they're transferred, when they leave the detention center for any reason whatsoever, including going to the hospital if they're ill, seriously ill, or going to a doctor outside the detention center. They're shackled at their wrist, waist, and ankles. And they're definitely shackled being transferred from one detention center to another across the country, and also shackled when they're deported. I guess the other way to be humane is to recognize the kinds of conditions that prompt people to leave everything that is dear to them, that the loved ones, as well as everything, you know, their homes, their loved ones, everything. It takes a lot for someone to just drop everything and leave.
I'm glad you said that because one of the things that I harp on constantly, especially as it relates to Central America and surrounding countries.
Right.
South America and Central America, but also knowing that it happens in African countries as well. But
right.
U.S. foreign policy and what American foreign policy has done to the economies in the countries from which these people are coming from, and nobody talks about that.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I think you put it much more graphically than I did, that the conditions that drive people to leave their homes and what is, you know, their loved ones and what is dear to them must be really awful for them to
endure. In fact, there are many who say for all of the indignities and suffering that people are enduring once they get here, it pales in comparison to the horrific conditions that they left.
Right. Yes. And I agree with you completely on that. And I'm...
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
You mentioned that in Broward County, Florida, you're dealing with a lot of migrants from African countries. And
I would say some. I wouldn't say a lot.
Okay. But that still takes me to my question. Is there a difference between the individuals that you are servicing in Broward County and those who are coming across the border from Mexico?
Most people who used, actually, the ones coming who are crossing the U.S.-Mexico border are no longer Mexicans, but are mostly people from Central America and other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Including Africa, also Asia, parts of Asia, India, Pakistan.
They're coming across the Mexico border as well?
Oh.
Okay.
Almost everyone who comes to the U.S. through the back door, so to speak,
yes,
is coming from, in other words, it's not really, it's so difficult to get a visa to come here, mm-hmm. So-called legally, that people have to come through the back door.
So they're not seeing Ellis Island and they're not reading the inscription on the base of the Statue of Liberty, bring me your...
Exactly.
Okay.
And so they take a roundabout route,
mm-hmm.
and end up no matter where they come from Asia, from Africa, you know.
That's incredibly interesting to me because the optics that we are given through mainstream corporate media, it fits the Donald Trump narrative of these hordes of crazed Mexicans that are running across the border, raping and pillaging and wreaking all kind of havoc in Arizona, California, and Texas, and New Mexico.
Exactly. Well, and those are basically since 2008, when the Great Reset, because of the Great Recession since 2008, actually migration from Mexico, meaning Mexicans,
mm-hmm.
migration of Mexicans, has declined precipitously since 2008. Which is not to say that there are not people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. There are thousands of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, but they're not Mexicans. They're coming from Central America and other parts of Latin America. They're coming from Haiti. They're coming from Cuba. Cubans are now no longer get on boats and travel across to Florida. They are coming the same route. They're coming on the same route that people from Africa are coming, which is mainly through South America, all through Central America, all through Mexico, and then present themselves at the U.S.-Mexico border requesting asylum.
Explain quickly, because we've heard Jeff Sessions say this, and we've heard the president say this, and we hear the Trump bots say whatever, of course, the president says, that, well, all you have to do is show up at the border at the appropriate place of demarcation and tell them that you're seeking asylum and you will be handled properly. Those of you who come through the border through illegal areas and means, you are going to be picked up and arrested. From what I understand, even those who cross the border at undesignated spots,
correct.
If they are picked up by a customs agent,
right.
All they have to do is say, I am seeking asylum, and they are supposed to be put into the same process that those who come through the designated entry points are.
That may be true in principle, but that's not, there are reports that they're not being granted that.
Well, and that's my point, that Jeff Sessions has not been telling the truth. And the president hasn't been telling the truth about the process and how people seeking asylum are supposed to be managed and dealt with.
Right. But even at official points of entry, where they're supposed to, accept your request for asylum, they're turned away,
right.
official points of entry. So if you're crossing at a place, at a location that's not an official port of entry, then I guess they can do whatever, the border agents can do whatever they wish, and many of them have been denying them the request for asylum.
Help me out with another data point, and that is Donald Trump and Sessions keep talking about ICE agents down on the border. But from what I understand, ICE agents aren't on the border. It's Border Patrol that's on the border, and the ICE agents are more of a domestic force that deals in urban and rural areas once those individuals have crossed the border.
That's true in principle.
Okay.
ICE mostly operates internally, inside the U.S. However, in the state of Florida, for example, the entire coastline of Florida is a border. So there's
great point.
There is no part of Florida that is less than 100 miles from a border. So, which is how it is, you know, which is how those people are getting arrested and detained by trying to travel on Greyhound buses.
Mm-hmm.
Which happened several months ago, because they were in Florida, and so they had, so ICE as well as the Border Patrol had the legal right to, you know, to arrest and detain them, getting on a Greyhound bus or while traveling in a Greyhound bus, because there's no part of Florida is less than 100 miles from the border. But so for the rest of the country, it's that 100 mile rule applies.
Mm-hmm.
So the border, all along California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and the other. You know, for the most part, it is the Customs and Border Protection agent who basically is dealing with these issues. But and for the most part, it's true that ICE deals with internal issues. But there are places where, you know.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Final question. We just have about 2 minutes left. So what is your take on Judge Boasberg's determination that the government can't summarily detain people out of hand, and the Trump administration cannot use indefinite detention as a weapon to punish and deter asylum seekers?
I welcome that. I welcome that. I mean, a lot of edicts or executive orders, signed by President Trump, have been challenged in the courts, you know, for ever since he took office.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, these court decisions eventually move up the chain to the Supreme Court. And, you know, the Supreme Court has not been ruling in a very positive way about immigration issues.
And how can people who want to help friends of Broward detainees, how can they contact you? How can they support your organization?
We have a Facebook page, and they can check us out on the Facebook page, Friends of Broward Detainees. And they can also email me. The email address is friendsofbrowarddetainees@gmail.com.
One more time, please.
Yeah. Friends of Broward Detainees, one word, @gmail.com.
Friends of Broward Detainees @gmail.com. Christine Ho, thank you so much for your work and so much for your time. Thank you for coming to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leon, and good luck with your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I applaud you. I applaud your work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all tomorrow right here on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.